KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners' weekly meeting for this week's public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Courthouse. This is KPTZ, Port Townsend.
Yeah, Willie will not be joining us today.
Oh, okay. Great. Well, Dr. Locke is here, so we'll pause for 1 second until the 9:45 time, and then we'll welcome the KPTZ listeners as well, and we'll pass it off to Dr. Locke.
I do have something, Mrs. Carolyn. I do have something. There is someone with a video link, and I wanted to identify if they were staff or someone who would be speaking up. I didn't recognize the name. McCall? McCall-Ola?
Meyer?
Anyhow, I just wanted to make sure. And I have 9:45 now.
Okay. So you have them muted as an administrator?
They are, but they have a video conference link, so they can unmute themselves. I just, I don't know who they are.
Well, they can unmute themselves.
This is Linda Saunders, and I have my Hawaiian name up there, but I'm waiting in for the Conservation Futures. I'm a board member, but I don't expect to speak, but I'm here.
Okay, that'll be 10:30.
Yeah, so I'm just listening to the rest of it. Sorry.
No, that's fine. Nope. Just thank you.
All right. Well, that mystery solved. We'll welcome the listeners from KPTZ and pass it over to Dr. Locke for the weekly update. How are we doing this week, Dr. Locke?
You're muted, Tom.
Great. Well, good morning. And I was my morning routine starts with reading the New York Times, and the New York Times, their headline today was the words bleak outlook is how they characterize the national picture, and that COVID-19 rates are now rising in 39 states, and in those states where it's been the worst. Texas, Florida, Arizona, it's getting even worse. These states are now at a point that they cannot test and contact trace their way out of the outbreak. They're in the exponential phase of growth, and they're going to have to backtrack and start shutting down. Some may even have to go back to the beginning and do shelter in home type things. And there's not yet the political will, it seems, to do that. So it's just a question of are they going to wait till their hospitals are over capacity, or what will be the trigger? The pattern, the first outbreaks were really serious ones were in the Northeast. Now it's very much the South, the West, and moving into the Midwest is the national pattern. And the determinants are pretty much what we've been predicting all along, and that is if you do rapid reopening before you have adequate control of transmission, then you end up accelerating transmission. There's also been a lack of masking and rigorous physical distancing, although that's changing. There are now, as of this weekend, there were 25 states, plus the District of Columbia, Washington being one of them, that had mandatory masking requirements in the state, and two more states will be added today. So it's now the majority of states, and I would predict that it's not going to be long before this is nationwide. This is turning out to be one of our best control strategies, but it only works if people use it and use it right. One of the questions from the KPTZ listeners was about the right way to wear masks. And it's not just over your mouth. You have to cover your nose and your mouth in order for it to be effective. And importantly, for you to get the benefit, the protective benefit that masks provide, because we now have pretty good evidence that the main exposure route and the most dangerous exposure route for COVID-19 is through our nose. We either breathe in infected particles, get them into our respiratory tract through our nose, or we can touch something and then put our fingers in our nose. And the reason the nose is such a significant pathway is that the receptors that the virus binds to, what are called the ACE2 receptors, they're much more plentiful in the nose than they are in the mouth or throat. It both for preventing you from contaminating the environment and to protect yourself, you need to have a mask over your nose. It makes no sense whatsoever to put on a mask and just cover your mouth. And I see people doing that all the time because it's a little more comfortable. You can breathe in fresh air if your nose isn't covered, but it really is defeating most of the benefit of wearing the mask. So U.S.-wise, we're now at a point where there's over 55,000 cases a day. The death rate has stayed below 500 a day, but it's starting to rise again. And unfortunately, we know it's going to keep going up because just given the amount of disease activity that's going on. And death rates are very much what are known as lagging indicators in a pandemic like this. Usually when people get this infection and succumb to it, die from it, that takes 3 or 4 weeks from the time of infection. And then it takes another couple weeks for the news of that death, the death certificate and the reporting to get into the system. So we're looking at 4 to 6 weeks after a death before it's even going to show up in the statistics. So that's what we're going to see over the next 4 to 6 weeks is the consequence of what's happening now in terms of high rates of transmission. Washington State, we're over 40,000 cases now statewide. Deaths are almost 1,500. The percent positivity has been holding pretty stable. It's at 5.9%, which is better than a lot of states. And actually, 5% is kind of a target number. The national guidelines are you should not reopen unless you have a rate below 5%. Here in Jefferson County, we're way below that rate. Our current positivity rate is 1.1%, and we've started doing some in-house calculations, and we'll be putting these on our website pretty soon. Because looking at 7-day rates, because that 1.1% rate is all of the tests we've done since March, and the positives divided by that. So it's more useful for us to look at what's been going on in the last week. And we ran some quick numbers of that, and it's for the last several weeks, it's been below 2% but we'll get some official numbers out this week on that. In the state, it's disturbing that the rates are going up again now in the I-5 corridor. We had a call with the state health officer on Friday, and she said as of Friday, they had computed the reproductive number, the R0, is now 1.6 in Western Washington. And that means that for every case is generating 1.6 additional cases. And whenever the R-naught is above 1, an epidemic grows. So we're back in a growing phase. We're actually at levels very similar to what was seen in March. But what we're not seeing, we are seeing the hospitals starting to have more patients, but we're not seeing that kind of surge and overwhelming demand that we saw in March. And the big reason is the people getting COVID-19 now in Washington State are much younger. And so they're less likely to need hospitalization and certainly much less likely to die from the infection. But they're not immune from the complications. Not only hospitalization, but also more and more we're seeing that people, as they recover from COVID-19, they can experience profound fatigue that lasts for months. They can have chronic cough and chest pain, residual impairment. We're seeing people with kidney injuries that we don't know how long they're going to last. So this kind of post-COVID syndrome, as it's being called, is being recognized more and more. Even healthy people without complication risks can get very severe disease and can have long-term consequences from it. So in Jefferson County, as of Friday, we were at 41 cases. We added 2 new cases this weekend. Doing weekend investigations has now become the norm for us, and we'll always do that. It's extremely important for control purposes that we react as quickly as possible. The state standard is you start a case investigation within 24 hours. Of learning of it. You know, we're almost always under an hour. We have teams that are ready to go at all times. And the patterns we're seeing in Jefferson County in the last several weeks, mostly folks with out-of-county exposures, and we're seeing, we've now had a number of contacts of confirmed cases who eventually tested positive, and that's those are actually success stories, because contacts are in quarantine after they've been notified of their exposure, and so when they become infected, they're already isolated, and they don't spread the case to someone else. So that's always good news, or at least it's how the system works. It means that we're controlling things. When we identify people who are at risk of the infection, you know, before they actually become contagious and spread it to others. Just to report on a few other things that probably the biggest new development or area of intense scrutiny, and you've probably heard about this, is this notion of how significant is airborne spread. For COVID-19. We've long known that the pathways that influenza uses, droplet transmission and what's known as contact transmission, are significant pathways. But there have been a growing number of outbreaks that can only really be explained by airborne spread. So very small particles, usually less than 5 microns in size, that are small enough that they can float in the air for periods of time. In lab conditions where you sort of manufacture ideal sized particles, they've been able to have documents air suspension for up to 3 hours and viable the virus in those samples, although we don't think those are at all typical in real-world situations. The things that more approximate human-generated aerosols are in a matter of minutes, 8 to 14 minutes, and very close vicinity to the person who is generating the particles. But we also, there's evidence that for the airborne transmission, you need to be exposed to a lot of it, because when a particle is very small, it can't carry that much virus. And so you need to be exposed to a lot of particles to get enough virus to become infected. We know that with COVID-19, a single virus, you know, if you're exposed to a single viron, you do not become sick from that. You need probably in the hundreds, maybe more, virus particles to actually cause infection. But we don't know the exact number. We do know that air currents really rapidly disperse aerosols, and it's this is pointing towards why outdoors is so much safer than indoors, and why ventilation when you're indoors is really important. You know, opening windows, using fans, trying to avoid poorly ventilated areas like windowless bathrooms. So I predict we're going to be seeing a lot more attention to ventilation and that as a control mechanism, including in schools, which is my segue to the final section here, and that is we're really moving into a very active phase of working with schools. I've been meeting with them on a regular basis, and there's state standards out that we've been reviewing, familiarizing ourselves, trying to adapt them to local conditions. And there's a broad consensus that this is a high priority goal to reopen schools. First and foremost, it's for the education of our children. It's crucial, but it also has a huge economic impact. For the when schools are closed, it's very difficult for parents to arrange childcare or for both parents to work. So we're very cognizant of that factor, but we have to do it in a way that's safe for the students and for the staff. And unfortunately, this is now yet another area that's been politicized at a national level, where there's threats of defunding and executive commands that really don't mean anything, because states are controlled or schools are controlled at a state and local level. But what's really needed for schools to safely reopen is not pressure from the federal government. It's the pandemic being under control, that we need to get the prevalence of the disease down to the point that we can safely reopen schools. Because if the infection is rare in the community, it's unlikely that we'll see outbreaks in the schools. But if we have high levels of circulating virus in a community, it's inevitable that we'll see that get into the schools and maybe be amplified by the schools. That's the big question with schools. We know that's a big factor with influenza. Schools really drive influenza outbreaks. But we have some reason to believe that may not be true with COVID-19. And most of that is international data. There's a number of countries that did not close their schools that have been able to keep them open and control the spread, and we're trying to learn from their example. But those successful countries, all of them had low prevalence of the disease in their communities. So that's the crucial variable. But we're moving ahead with those plans, but we need to get things in better levels of statewide, certainly. We are at the levels in Jefferson County right now, prevalence-wise, that you know, that we would, I would not recommend holding off on opening schools, you know, where, but that's gonna be a continuous struggle. Had a couple KPTZ listener questions. I'll try to answer quickly. There was a question on blood type and susceptibility to infection, and there is research on this, that in the ABO blood typing system, there is some statistical evidence that people with type A blood have an increased risk of COVID-19 complications. Why that is, we have no idea. And it could be a statistical fluke. It might not be a real thing. But there's actually some pretty solid data that says if you just look at hospitalization rates, if you have type A blood, it's more likely. Type A blood is very common. It's the most common blood type. Personally, I have type A blood. I'm not worried about it for that reason. There were questions about testing delays at the University of Washington, and actually we're getting pretty good turnaround from UW. Most of the tests from Jefferson County go to the University of Washington lab, and we get about we're averaging around 36-hour turnaround time. That's actually pretty good and fulfills our purposes. The Jefferson Healthcare Lab can do testing in-house, but they have a very limited supply of the chemical reagents, so they only use that test for high-priority inpatients and emergency room patients and cases like that. Nationally, there's starting to be a big slowdown in the big national labs, LabCorp and Quest, and they're getting 5 to 7 day turnaround and even longer. And this is a big problem in Eastern Washington, where a lot of the small rural communities use these national labs. So one of the things the health officers talked about on Friday is we're trying to get these clinics to switch over to Washington-based labs. We actually have a lot of testing capacity in this state. We have unused testing capacity, and so we're right now it's not acceptable to have a week-long delay in test results. It just doesn't give us the lead time we need to control things. So we don't recommend that anyone use those. But for right now, the University of Washington is giving us the turnaround time we need. There was a question about dental visits and preventive dental visits, and of course these are always a good idea, but people will probably have a very hard time scheduling them right now because dentists have a big backlog from their several months of being closed, and the shortages or limited availability of N95 masks is a big problem for dentists, because in dentistry nowadays has to be done with full airborne precautions, because dental procedures generate a lot of aerosols, and so N95 masks are, for many dental offices, are a limiting factor as to how many cases they can do. So mostly dentists are focusing on urgent and restorative services, and they've been doing emergencies all along. But their ability to fit in preventive care and annual visits and those things is really limited at this point. There was a question, is it okay to have lunch in an employee lunchroom without a mask? My answer to that is no. I would try to avoid eating without masks with any non-household members, which presumably most of your coworkers are non-household members. So it probably is okay to eat outdoors 6 feet apart without a mask with a non-household member. But indoors, it's safer to eat by yourself. That is an avoidable risk. Some concerns about seeing employees in restaurants and coffee shops not wearing masks, and a complaint system for that. And because we in public health do have a special relationship with food service establishments, we license them, we inspect them. We have been developing a program for dealing with complaints when we get them from restaurants. And our first response is to make sure they understand what the requirements are and how important they are. But there are kind of escalating sanctions if restaurants are not in compliance with the state mandates, which is a labor and industry mandate and also has state enforcement and actually pretty significant penalties. So the only reason you should see someone, an employee without a mask, is if they have a medical exemption. And even then, it doesn't necessarily make it safe for them to do face-to-face transactions with customers. You know, work at cash registers or wait tables. Those things we're really telling employers unmasked individuals cannot do. And I would point out that face shields are not a substitute for masks in occupational settings. They are allowed in public. They will be allowed in schools as an alternative to face coverings, but not in occupational settings. You need to wear a mask to be able to do the full range of things that you would do in an occupational setting. So I'll I think I've answered all the KPTZ questions, but I'd be glad to entertain any that the commissioners might have.
Thanks, Dr. Locke. I'd like to follow up on the last answer about face shields real quick. If you have a face shield and then some sort of buff around the neck, is that a different case? I mean, that's how even the nurses that are collecting samples at the drive-up clinic do it. It was with a face shield and then a cloth protector around kind of the neck.
Right. Well, and that's at the drive-through clinic. That's a special kind. That's what's known as a PAPR hood, which is a filtered, pressurized air system. It's kind of the gold standard of respiratory protection, and it has a fitted collar around it to collect secretions. So that's perfectly acceptable. And just the plain plastic face shields that stop at the level of the chin, those don't provide adequate source control. There are some new models of those that have been developed that actually have a kind of a collar around the bottom that appear to be much better. We'll be seeing more and more of those, I think. So modified face masks may offer a much better source control, as we say. And people can kind of rig a modified face shield if they put some kind of drape, a scarf or a handkerchief or something around their neck to try to catch the droplets. So when you wear a face shield, it does prevent you from expelling droplets, you know, launching them out from your airway because they crash into the face shield, and some of them get trapped on the face shield, but others escape around the edges and get into the environment. So we don't have good research on face shields. What we have suggests that they're just not good at source control. Their value is much more for personal protection. So in healthcare settings, for instance, we wear surgical masks and a face shield, but there the face shield is mostly to protect your eyes.
Gotcha. Thank you. One other quick, I guess, just clarification about enforcement, mask enforcement right now. I know that you said environmental public health is kind of standing up a process for food service establishments that they already have a licensing a relationship with. And so complaints about a food service relationship would go to public health in a soon-to-be-stood-up portal. Other businesses is a complaint to the state, to LNI, if they've got bad practices that are out of compliance with the state's mandate. And then about people just on the streets, if there really isn't. Is that correct?
Correct. And people just out of doors on the street, that's really our lowest priority. There's no requirement at all to wear a mask outdoors if you're greater than 6 feet away from someone else. And if you're only within 6 feet for a very short period, you know, passing on the sidewalk, those are pretty insignificant exposures. It's fine certainly to wear a mask outdoors in public settings, and it does give you some protection, but it's really the indoor exposures that we're concerned about, and outdoors, these very close face-to-face conversations. Those are where the risks are.
Great, thank you. Kate, David, questions?
Yeah, I've got a couple. Hi, Dr. Locke, thanks for being here this morning. I just want to call out disturbing news from Clallam County, where we're seeing a pretty big uptick in cases, largely linked to family gatherings, it sounds like. Is that something you want to speak to? Or?
Yeah, definitely. That's what they're reporting. They had, I think, four cases on Friday. They had five cases on Saturday. I haven't heard the Sunday tally yet, but they're definitely linked to 4th of July gatherings. One of our cases this weekend was linked to a 4th of July gathering, actually out of state, but 4th of July nonetheless. And so we're I think that's the shape of things to come, is people are really getting tired of the restrictions, and they want to get back to life as usual, but life isn't as usual. You know, we're in the middle of a pandemic, and I wish it was. I don't even think that's accurate to say we're in the middle. You know, we are, you know, in the second or third inning of this. As you know, if you use the baseball analogy, so we're. We're not even at the midpoint of this. So people need to brace themselves for some you know, seriously looking at our behaviors and changing them so that we can live safely in this pandemic environment.
Do you think that there's a way to travel safely and responsibly this summer?
It's yes. I mean, you know, people can go camping, although it's recommended to, you know, really stay as close to home as possible, avoid crowded camping areas. People can stay in hotels. You need to maintain the physical distancing is the key, and to do as much outside as possible. But you know, doing the big multi-state trips and airline travel, these kind of that are the more traditional summer vacation type things, are really risky this year. And there are ways to reduce the risk, but there's no way to eliminate it completely. And people, as they travel, and especially, you know, if we stay on the current trajectory, they're going to find more and more things closed. They're going to find, you know, restaurants are restricted if they're having indoor dining at all. It's not going to be easy to travel. So the advice, and I think it's good advice, is you know, travel within your county, certainly within your state, and do it in a way where you're mindful of the fact that people who look and act completely healthy can in fact be carrying the virus and be unintentionally shedding it.
Okay, thank you. And one more question. I took my partner in for surgery on Tuesday at the UW Medical Center and was there for 14 hours or something all day, saw the whole hospital, and was really surprised. They were very strict about masking, and they did symptom check when he came in, but then there was none of the protocol that even our hospital has with cards for distancing or disinfecting purposes, no kind of markings on floors or anything. And I was just surprised. I was wondering, do they know something we don't, that if you have 100% masking and they could strictly control it, was that enough? You know, and there was absolute adherence to that. But it was just surprising compared to our hospital to see less mitigations in place.
Yeah, and generally the UW has generally runs a tight ship in terms of infection control. So I'm not quite sure what their thinking is behind that. We generally use really strict disinfection standards in hospitals even before COVID-19. Because there are a long list of deadly infections that can be transmitted in hospitals. You know, hospitals are the place where if you have one of those life-threatening infections, we invite you to come in and stay in the hospital while we treat you. So it's kind of concentrated risk, infection-wise. And we almost never see person-to-person transmission in hospitals because of the precautions. So I'm honestly not sure what their thinking is in terms of not emphasizing distancing and disinfection. But maybe it points out the fact that, you know, our hospital is doing a great job of this. You know, we're taking it really seriously, and that's how we should. You know, a hospital should be a safe place to go. You should go there to get better, not to pick up a new infection.
And I don't say it to discredit that facility at all. It felt very safe. People were giving each other distance. Everyone was masked all the time. It didn't feel unsafe, but I just wondered if there's a new understanding that masks are enough or something along those lines.
It's the mask plus distancing. Those are the two key things. But we are de-emphasizing this hyper disinfection type thing. It really does not seem to be necessary. It's not. You can transmit through a contact route. But it seems to be a minor risk compared to the respiratory route. But distancing is crucially important. Probably as important as masking.
And maybe they maintain that with just allowing very few people into the facility. And you know, you can't have more than one person accompany you, so you're not going to be in groups, congregated in groups. So. Thank you.
So, commissioners, did you ask Dr. Locke about contact time with disinfectant, the issue that was raised by Citizen this morning? So the concern that was raised this morning, Dr. Locke, and you just talked about the de-emphasis of disinfection, but raising concern about that the various disinfectants, it was alleged in the comment this morning, that there's a minimum contact time in order for them to be effective, and that many of the practices of using wipes doesn't give the contact time to be effective, and we're suggesting that there be additional training.
Yeah, that is very true. The contact time varies with each particular disinfectant. So there are things that have relatively fast disinfection activity, alcohol-based things, for instance, are usually in a matter of seconds to minutes. And then there's others, you know, this common disinfectant that's used, quaternary ammonia, it needs up to 10 minutes of contact time. And it usually, if it's an improved disinfectant, it should actually say on the container what the contact time is.
Right? It needs to stay wet for that amount of time.
Yeah. It's although some of them, the alcohol-based ones won't stay wet for but it's that drying, that rapid drying of the alcohol is what kills the virus. So the alcohol-based ones, which are a fire hazard, I guess I should add, but they're the most used in healthcare settings because they work the fastest and they're among the most effective.
Okay. And let's see, there was another question, and I'm trying to remember what it was, that was from a citizen for Dr. Locke.
Long-term care facilities and caregiving testing.
I saw that in my email feed from another source, perhaps. One of the reasons that we've seen the death rate go down in Washington State is we've gotten much better at preventing outbreaks in nursing homes, long-term care facilities, and we've gotten much better at responding rapidly to them. And one of the things we're doing is staff, so workers in nursing homes are now tested every 2 weeks, just as a routine, so irrespective of any symptoms. We don't test nursing home residents. There was a period at the end of May where all nursing home residents in Washington State were tested, just as a baseline. But we only test staff, and then we test nursing home residents if there's been any kind of exposure. But nowadays in nursing homes, the residents are really, things are being maintained in a very strict way. Generally no visitors, people are staying in their rooms, so a lot of precautions are being taken to prevent exposure, but there is routine twice a month testing of staff as the new norm.
What about staff that does in-home care? So it was mentioned services like KWA. Oftentimes the people that are still in their homes are also quite vulnerable, however, and the home care workers are going from home to home. And so that was a question about testing for them.
Yeah, and we're currently not doing that as a routine. There are other precautions that are being taken for home health workers in terms of masking and infection control training. It's not a current protocol. We're not seeing outbreaks connected with home health services. It was really in the congregate care setting of long-term care facilities seemed to be what was driving the outbreaks. It's not an unreasonable thing to consider. In fact, we're looking for what are the kind of the asymptomatic screenings that make sense. You know, currently we're doing a lot of screenings before procedures, before surgeries, before dental procedures. We're doing nursing home screenings. There's a lot of studies being done to see if it makes sense to do screening of other groups. But of the asymptomatic tests we do, it's still pretty rare that we pick people up. And tests are not free. Even though people are not being charged for it, it costs about $100 per test to do these. And the resources used to them are limited. So we have to be really thoughtful about which tests we do. We do not want to waste this precious resource.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Locke. We have a 10:30 hearing, but we'll take a couple questions from David if you have some, and maybe shut them off for a minute or two. Go ahead, David.
Well, concerned about the school staff and the teachers, the volunteers, is there conversation going on about that? Because their bench isn't very deep, a lot of them.
Right, right. No, there's intense concern, and we're really looking at that. We have to make that environment safe. And I'll be reporting at the Board of Health meeting on Thursday. I'll be talking a lot more about the schools and what we're doing with them then.
One of the comments that reminded me, one of the comments for you, Dr. Locke, this morning was regarding schools and other things like restaurants and ventilation, and whether there needs to be some sort of analysis of ventilation within the schools. And I don't know that it necessarily is practical to think that they could be retrofit for additional ventilation, but do you have some comments on that?
It is an issue that OSPI at the state level and the schools at local level, they're looking at that. They're trying to see what is the best we can do with our current condition. Rebuilding HVAC systems in the next month is not a realistic thing. But you can change filters, you can use higher efficiency filters, you can increase air exchange rates and things like that. So they're looking at all of that.
I guess the last thing is just the concern about how the rest of the country impacts us in terms of resources available, whether it be testing or equipment or people to do contact testing or tracing. Maybe that's more of a Willie question. Maybe I'll wait for next week.
If from my standpoint, it's a huge impact because we're all competing for a finite resource. So we're starting to see shortages of personal protective equipment again. And some places have shortage of testing materials. It's why I always start with the national picture. We exist in this national community, and we don't have a coherent national strategy for dealing with this. The CDC has been sidelined. We are doing this state by state, which is just a crazy way to do it.
So as you mentioned earlier, Dr. Locke, that Jefferson Healthcare has a limited supply of reagents for doing testing. Is there anything that either emergency management or that we can and should be doing to try to increase the supply of reagents for local testing?
Unfortunately, I think it's out of our control, and what they use is specific to the type of machine they have, which is actually one of the best testing technologies in the country. And so the manufacturer just has a limited amount of reagents they can make for that machine, and there's a bunch of hospitals competing for that. So it's a sole source manufacturer, and it's a limited supply. But they're trying to ramp up production as much as possible. It's just that we think it'll improve over time, but right now we have to conserve that resource because we need emergency testing available.
I have one or two quick questions, and then we could really get to our 10:30 hearing. But did I hear you say today that a virus particle is called a viron?
Yes, that's a single virus is known as a viron.
Very cool. Always nice to up the vocabulary. And I was I just wanted to reiterate what you said about the importance of wearing masks over the nose as well as the mouth, and that being really about that's the protection that it affords me is really that the aerosols, most of the aerosols are coming into the nose when people are getting infected.
Yeah, yeah. So when you have it over your nose, you are filtering the air you breathe through the mask, which is a good thing.
Great. And then finally, I just, looking at what's going on in Scandinavia and the experiments essentially that Sweden did, I think really shows that false dichotomy of choosing the economy or public health as the kind of their strategy of not really shutting down had the same economic impact as their Scandinavian neighbors that had much, much more robust strategies and much fewer deaths and hospitalizations and the same impact. And I was wondering if you could just, comment on that briefly.
Yeah, no, I very much agree with that. I think it's choosing between lives and livelihood is a false choice. We have to choose both. We have to maximize both. I think what we're trying to do in this state is the right balance, and we'll talk more at the Board of Health meeting about the phased reopening and where we are. We're having a state meeting on that tomorrow, so I'll report on that. I think that the Swedish information is sobering, and they're a sophisticated country. They were doing a lot of things right. But they now regret some of the decisions they made.
Great. Okay. Unless there's any last quick question.
I think one of the other revelations that I've read about recently is just the lack of a summer pause. That because you have to have much less virus in the community to have that be effective or have a lot more people have immunity before that's effective. And so we're not going to get that summer pause everybody was counting on.
Yeah, that's regrettable. This is right now is probably the best, as good a pause as we're going to get.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Dr. Locke. Very informative as always. And thank you to KPTZ and our listeners for tuning in. And we will let you go, Dr. Locke. And thanks to the attendees for our next hearing for their patience as we dealt with these important questions.
This is KPTZ Port Townsend. We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Board of County Commissioners meeting at the courthouse.